And going from 49th out of 50 in quality, almost worst in the nation, to 22nd in the nation. That kind of change in 2 years doesn't happen easily.
Hello and welcome to Clinical Changemakers, the podcast that explores vital lessons in healthcare leadership, innovation, and so much more. I'm your host, Dr. Jono. Today on the show, we have Dr. Nirav Shah. Dr. Shah is a medical doctor and senior scholar at Stanford University. He is a published academic author and is a chief medical officer at American Health Associates and chief medical officer at ShareCare. He is the former commissioner of health for New York State and advises to a number of public and private companies, including the CDC, GSR Ventures, and Steris. Dr. Nirav Shah, welcome to the podcast.
It's nice to be here.
Now, I'm looking forward to talking to you about your former role as New York State's health commissioner, as well as your other roles across the private and public healthcare industry. But before we do, it would be great to learn a little bit about your background and how you found your way into healthcare.
My parents are immigrants from India, and I was born and raised in Buffalo, New York. Growing up in Buffalo, with a father who's an engineer, he always emphasized helping others as part of your profession is a very gratifying way to do good and do well. And Indian parents, they gave me three choices. I could be a physician, a doctor, or an MD when I grew up. Being a good Indian boy, I listened to my parents, and it was actually a very interesting, the sciences were always of interest, and lack of any strong motivation in any other direction meant I listened to my parents and followed the pursuit of medicine in college as an undergrad, and then medical school at Yale, residency also at Yale in internal medicine, followed by a fellowship with the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at UCLA. And after that, I was done with my training in my 30s.
Just touching on your residency and that bit of philosophy that you mentioned earlier around serving others, of course, when many of us think of healthcare and medicine, it's only once you're in it, you really experience what it's truly like. If you could reflect on those resident years at Yale, what did you learn about the American healthcare system, and what did you learn about yourself?
I remember a patient, I'll call her Miss Garcia, who was one of my pivotal patients, who taught me a lot about myself, about healthcare, and where I wanted to spend my time. She was a typical older woman who spoke Spanish only, and I did not speak Spanish, who I would visit with probably once every quarter, once every 3 months. She'd come in for refills, just a check-in, some blood work, things like that. Multiple medications, multiple chronic conditions. And I really got to know her very well over my years and loved her. One day she came in a little early because her daughter was taking her on vacation. And so as I usually did, I refilled all her medications. And I saw that her calcium was going down. And so I gave her another form of calcium. A week later, Ms. Garcia was in the hospital because she dutifully took all of her old medications, but then doubled up on the calcium. And with poor kidney function, her calcium went through the roof, and she was quite ill. Luckily, she recovered, but I learned a lot about myself, about patient safety and quality, about the unintended consequences of medicine, about what I did to her. And I started to focus on how we could do better, and thinking about and learning about systems for improvement, Lean, Six Sigma, quality improvement. And that was early on one of the ahas, that if I can make such a simple mistake with language issues, with a vulnerable patient, and really put her in a very dire situation, what could I do differently? And how could I change the system so that the next time something like this happens, someone catches it in advance, someone explains to the patient, or it just doesn't happen in the first place. So that's an example where in residency, your formative years, your patients are so generous and they teach you, sometimes unintentionally, how to be a better physician, how to be a better caring clinician. That really helped shape some of the decisions I made and what I focused on in subsequent years.
During that time, were there any mentors or perhaps leadership models that you were sort of starting to think about and maybe head towards?
Absolutely. I was very lucky from my undergraduate years to have incredible medical mentors. Dr. Tom Chalmers, former dean of Mount Sinai, was at the Harvard School of Public Health, where I did research in his lab for 4 years as an undergrad. And he was so generous with his time, his advice, his energy. He was the one who convinced me to go to Yale and work with Drs. Alvin Feinstein and Dr. Ralph Horwitz. All of these were giants in medicine. And subsequently, I was lucky to benefit from other mentors like that along the way, who said, Nirav, you're good at this, stay here, double down on what you're good at, mitigate what you're weak at. Don't try to fix everything, but try to fix what you're really good at and become even better so you can contribute. And that's where the role of mentors, every stage of my career since then, and now a very diverse set of mentors, have led to skip-level opportunities, harsh self-reflection on my part sometimes, but progress every single day. At least I like to think that.
With this type of experience, you know, honing in and doubling down on your strengths, how do you feel that the public health training that you've done and undergraduate training was able to be expressed? Because as a clinician, being on the front line, there is often only the patient-to-patient interaction that we can influence. So how did you kind of manage to work across that tension between the broader system level changes and then what you can do on the front line?
That's a great question. And in clinical medicine, we didn't learn anything about public health. I think there was maybe one course or maybe about a week of lectures in public health through medical school. But I also got my master's in public health instead of my fourth year of medical school, instead of doing electives at Yale. And that was priceless because all the principles of prevention, population health, systems thinking, and understanding the data, learning epidemiology, biostatistics, those are skills that I've carried with me both as a clinician and every day since as a leader. I think it's vital that we get more public health training as physicians, because if we really want to change society, you better understand what levers are really available. It's starting to seep into clinical medicine more and more. The focus on the social determinants of health is a great example where most doctors wouldn't have been able to tell you what that is maybe about 10 years ago, but now I would challenge you to find a doctor who hasn't understood the role of the social determinants in their care of patients. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done. We certainly continue to underinvest in public health, and just look at what is happening to the CDC as an example. And if we really want to make population level changes, we as clinicians need to start to emphasize the role of public health.
Yeah, and I think what you're perhaps speaking to as well is the advocacy style of role that clinicians can have, and that leadership is not only within your team or within your institution, but perhaps is a broader form of leadership. Now, speaking to that, I know that you've been involved in a number of initiatives outside of perhaps a conventional role around a petition for doctors to limit painkillers. I wondered if you could speak to that experience and why you decided to take that on and what you learned.
Well, early on in our tenure, this was probably around 2011 or 12, we saw the early problems of the opioid epidemic taking off in New York State. And many patients were doctor shopping at that time. It was very easy to get a script from one physician and another script from another physician simultaneously. And it led to a huge problem with the abuse of opiates, sale of opiates for illicit use on the street, and on and on. We put in a very simple program where doctors who prescribed opiates had to register that with the state with an online program. They just, you know, I prescribed Mrs. Jones this medicine on this day. And for future prescriptions, if you wanted to write a prescription, you had to just check the database. Overnight, that stopped the doctor shopping in the state of New York. It didn't cross state lines at the time, but it did make a significant dent early on in the opioid epidemic in America and allowed us to then focus on treatment, on prevention, and other areas rather than the downstream consequences of having many addicted folks.
That must have been really rewarding work. And I think one thing it highlights, particularly for non-clinical folk listening, is just how disconnected many systems that we have in healthcare are. And through thoughtful problem solving and linking these types of systems up, and obviously investment too, we can change things, you know, seemingly overnight in some sorts of cases.
I wish it were that easy, Jono. I wish it were that easy. There's always second order effects that you don't plan for, that you don't think about. Because we didn't have adequate resources for treatment and prevention, we didn't have folks prescribing buprenorphine enough, we didn't have all of these other things that now hindsight is 2020. What we partially did was result in more use of heroin. When desperate patients didn't have a solution, they turn to heroin. And we know we caused that by an effective program that stopped shopping for prescription opiates. So I think the lesson learned, but to the extent that complex systems changes requires many iterative solutions over time, and there are going to be untoward consequences that you have to plan for and that you can't plan for, but that you have to address when in real time. That was one of many untoward consequences of the doctor shopping program.
Now, you became the health commissioner of New York State. I wondered if you could comment for a moment about the scale of that role and what were the types of responsibilities that you had going into a position like that.
This was, again, an opportunity created by mentors for me. Mac Lipkin, one of the professors at NYU Bellevue, helped me with preparing for this interview and my bio and other questions for the interviews. The Health Commissioner of New York is one of the few states where we have oversight over Medicaid. So that was a $50 billion Medicaid spend every year, in addition to public health, regulatory over 80,000 licensed physicians, 200 hospitals, 600 nursing homes, almost all of healthcare oversight other than mental health and for folks with disabilities. Those were separate agencies. So it was a really large role on paper, and we had approximately 5,000 staff in Albany and spread throughout the state, with a complex budgeting process many levels of review. For me, it was a chance of a lifetime. I learned how to be a leader in the crucible and was very lucky to make many lasting relationships with staff who care deeply about improving the welfare and health of New Yorkers.
Sounds like a very big role. And, you know, at first glance, you think, wow, you know, what a amazing amount of, you know, power to influence healthcare in a positive way. But of course, when you move into these roles, the system has been working for a while and there is momentum and there is process. What was it like when you sort of first got your feet under the table and kind of had to understand, you know, what levers were possible to pull, what levers were, you know, on their way to being pulled, and what levers to maybe not touch for at least a period of time?
I think the tendency of every new leader initially is to be excited and see everything that's possible and everything that's wrong that you want to fix overnight. And the reality is you have to be much more humble. Things are a certain way because of how things have been done for 30, 40, 50 years, how legacy systems have been built up, how problems in the past have been fixed in a certain way by the bureaucrats to make sure they don't happen again, which results in something that may seem archaic when you're looking at it without the lens of history. So for me, as with all leaders, I think I came in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed saying, I want to fix A, B, C, D, E, F, G, but then quickly learning what I could and couldn't fix and how I could rely on those with much more knowledge, expertise, and experience to lead the way. And really just my job was to give them air cover. As much as I had, I certainly had my own initiatives and I pushed them, but it was more about understanding the opportunity through the lens of what does the governor need, what's happening in financing and the current economic cycle, what are the regulatory pressures coming from the feds, and all of these stakeholders in this complex environment to try to set burning platforms where you could and create that policy window to make rapid change in a lot in a little amount of time as best as possible. So it came from a place of I want to do things to I want to foster things. I want to help things happen. And I did things too. I'm not saying like, you know, we moved to a more electronic systems across the board. And I helped lead that by demanding that people email me a one-page document, not just give me a piece of paper. I walked around with an iPad all the time. So people thought that I'm an electronic health commissioner. And even my official portrait in Albany today has me standing with an iPad. And it led to a lot of good things when we had electronic data systems for the very first time across all of healthcare, that public health could access Medicaid and Medicaid could look at the regulatory and all, as opposed to the siloed paper-based systems we had prior to my arrival.
And I think picking up on that, you know, something as a leader is about being visible and modeling behaviors. But I think underpinning all of that is creating trusted relationships. I wondered if you could speak to any other practices or approaches that you had that, you know, when you're coming into a role like this and perhaps there's lots of people who have been in an organization for a long time, how did you go about building those trusted relationships?
In medicine, in clinical medicine, Francis Peabody said that the secret of the care of the patient is in caring for the patient. And it's not dissimilar in that when you're working with folks, you build that trust by actually authentically caring about them, their interests, their growth trajectories, their body of work, who they are, what they want to do, how they want to do it. And so for me, that was the first principle in my interactions with just about everyone. I actually got to know folks as an individual first and have them get to know me with all my foibles, with all my opportunities for improvement and how I did things, how I thought, so that they could almost replace me as needed. Over time, it became that my 12 principal deputies knew me so well and I knew them so well that they would send my secretary emails for our various customers, whether it's someone in the Senate or someone in a hospital or someone else, and that my secretary would send out the email on my email account and BCC me so I knew what I sent out, even though it was authored by one of my principal deputies. And that way we were able to move much faster together because there's things that only I could do with my imprimatur from my office versus them being able to do. And it allowed us to make rapid changes at scale because of that trust built up with each deputy over time. And we worked as a team, as an interdependent team. And that allowed a lot to happen in a short amount of time. One statistic I like to quote is, we were collectively able to save New York taxpayers $34 billion over 5 years in our Medicaid program by doing things more efficiently, by doing things more sensibly. And that was while we expanded the program to 1 million more New Yorkers, to 5 million New Yorkers taking advantage of the Medicaid program, and going from 49th out of 50 in quality, almost worst in the nation, to 22nd in the nation. That kind of change in 2 years doesn't happen easily. It happens because you'd get the best ideas from everyone in the state and have ways to create the system changes and effectuate those ideas in real time. A simple example, generic substitution of medications. We went from a rate of 70s into the high 90s, which saved hundreds of millions of dollars to the Medicaid program for the exact same medication. Not rocket science, but just putting in the systems to make that happen that someone had an idea for allowed us to do good and do well.
And it sounds like there's just a lot of empowerment within the culture and the teams. But just picking up on the savings, you know, that's an astronomical amount of money. That's incredible. One thing I'd be curious to understand, did you or the state get to realize those savings, i.e. those savings then get able to be diverted into services that, you know, need additional funding or what have you?
Absolutely. One of the early initiatives that actually Don Berwick advised me on was creating a transparency website. And we were able to publish the costs and charges for just about everything in the state of New York, not just a few medications, but how much does it cost to be hospitalized in Hospital A versus Hospital B across the street with severity adjustment, et cetera, et cetera. So we literally published all that data. And that data, there were errors in the data. There were articles in the New York Times saying, why does it only cost $2 to get a colonoscopy at Fox Chase? Well, they fixed that data feed to us immediately thereafter. And so the data got better and we were able to make decisions based on the data. Do you really need 18 hours of home care a day? That's what we're apparently seeing in the data and saying, no, we don't need that, but we need to retrain the workforce from inpatient to supporting people at home. And we were able to do this at scale in a way that led to the federal government saying, we love what you're doing, keep doing it. We applied for something called a Medicaid waiver to allow us to keep futzing with the rules and trying new things. And we were awarded an $8 billion waiver from Medicaid. That's new dollars in to continue to advance the innovation, the moving from hospital to home, and the right upstream preventive measures that saved people downstream and saved money at the same time.
And what you're highlighting there is kind of the power of transparency, where if you set up the scenario where, you know, we are going to be transparent and we're not only going to learn, but we're going to enact those learnings, then you start building the integrity and the trust within the system, and you get these sort of virtuous cycles, which you're kind of highlighting there. But you are going to need to probably go through a little bit of bruising, I suspect, when the data isn't quite accurate, but that's all part of the course, and I suspect a big part of communicating what you're going to do and involving stakeholders so that they're aware of what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I'll give you another example. When we were looking at all of my patients who showed up at Bellevue, there was a substantial minority of folks who on cold winter days would come in. These were homeless people who clearly had medical needs as well, but were coming in for essentially a social admission. And so we were able to look through the Medicaid rolls and identify 27,824 patients. And so we could identify those folks, put them in supportive housing, and save Medicaid billions of dollars over time, because what they actually needed was a social solution, not a medical solution. Those are the kinds of things that it wasn't a red state, blue state thing. It was more a matter of, we're going to save this money. You guys can find other ways to save that money, but we're going to build the supportive housing and get it done. Unless you can create bigger savings than that, we're going to go forward with that. And those that was one of many of the kind of big wins driven by data that achieved triple aim outcomes: higher quality care, scalable at lower cost.
And this role, as I understand it, is also a political appointment. Is that correct? What was it like navigating politics in the public eye, considering the kind of work that you'd done prior?
It was a very steep learning curve. I bought all the books I could on this. I bought a book called The First 90 Days in Government by Mitch Watkins, I believe. Read it cover to cover and got great advice from many others who've been in similar roles. And part of it is knowing how to give away credit, right? The governor needs to have good news from his administration above the fold, New York Times front page with his name on it. The senators and assemblymen and women also need similar credit. Meanwhile, I remember that the reflected glory of all the good work goes to the citizens of New York. So to the extent that we were able to apportion credit to whoever appropriately deserved it and needed it, we were able to get good work done very quickly. It needed to, the stakeholders, I'll give an example. When we worked on a big program to help end the AIDS epidemic. We needed the support of the police commissioner because at the time in New York, condoms were being used as evidence for prostitutes to be put in jail. And explaining to the police commissioner that, you know, this is helping spread AIDS. If they're disincentivized to use condoms or carry them, we need to change this policy. And similarly, going across all the education commissioner needed to do one thing, housing works needed to do some things, all of these different stakeholders had to come together to create that policy bucket of things to help decrease the transmission of HIV and AIDS. At the end, when we passed all of that, I went to the police commissioner and appropriately said, you're a part of the solution. You gave us this. You made the policy changes that are going to help aid end AIDS. And without his part and role in that, things would have happened. But it took the collective efforts of everyone and my personally going and thanking publicly each and every one of those participants so that the goodwill keeps going. And the next time I need help, I'll also get it. So, you know, that's one example of the lessons learned about in a highly visible public role, making sure that you're satisfied with the outcomes that benefit individuals, as opposed to seeing your own name in the paper, is part of how you actually get things done.
Now, your role as Health Commissioner from around 2011 to 2014, there were a number of challenges, I'm sure. And one, I believe, was around Hurricane Sandy and how that impacted a number of hospitals as well as the broader society. Now, if we fast forward to 2020 with COVID and all of the immense amount of harm that it's caused around the world, but New York City seems to be an epicenter of that harm. I wonder if you reflect on how your experience of that crisis, what you learned about the role and the health system at that stage, and whether or not you can reflect on perhaps what happened in New York City during the COVID outbreak.
They often say that you shouldn't do policy work until you turn 50 or something. And I totally ignored that. I didn't understand that. And with Hurricane Superstorm Sandy, I spent about a month in the bunker in Long Island City, sitting alongside all of the New York City leadership as well, just coordinating the evacuation of 8 large 1,000-bed hospitals, the services for patients with dialysis to emergency care to you name it. All of that in real time, different agencies had different jurisdiction, different abilities. And the only way to do that was to physically be there with all of them in the same room so you could put out fires before they became too large. I didn't see my kids much or my wife much during that month, right? They'd drive down from Albany. We'd go for dinner maybe once or twice a week, and then they'd go back while I stayed on in New York City. Public service can be an all-consuming 24/7 job, and it's a calling. And so I understand why you want your kids to be grown up or otherwise occupied before you take on such roles. So for public folks considering public service, it's an incredible privilege. You will be given opportunities like nobody else, and you don't feel you deserve it. But there is a tough downside as well. And so after 4 years of doing that, it was time for me to go back to seeing my family regularly, having meals with them, not having a Friday fire drill almost every week where some hospital in upstate New York lost their laboratory and you have to figure it out, because if they don't get their laboratory up and running over the weekend, there's going to be no OR time on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and they're on such razor-thin margins, that'll shut the hospital down. And it's my job, supposedly, to fix all of this. So those are the kinds of things that mean you have to go into public. I think talented people should go into public service roles like this, but go in with eyes wide open about how difficult it is. I cannot second guess what happened during the COVID pandemic in New York City. On the ground, it's completely different than what you read in the papers. I remember all the misreporting that happened around Hurricane Sandy and the Herculean efforts of so many people that were just mischaracterized because the New York Times wanted a headline and wanted to stir up the pot, which led to a lot of damage. So it gave me a new appreciation of what the role of media could be and versus what it actually was on the ground. Same thing with her, with COVID. I suspect that on the ground, I know many people actually were even carried out in stretchers from the Department of Health because they were working nonstop and physically collapsed. So I will never second guess any individual who's working hard in the field. I would suggest that you walk a mile in their shoes before you understand that the many pressures they face, and I'm sure they did the best that they could given the data and the circumstances that evolved very quickly.
And just speaking to the pressures and challenges of people who work in the public service, do you have any thoughts on what we could be doing to reshape that environment such that not only are they able to fulfill their duties, but actually thrive, such that people can have, you know, perhaps longer careers or not burn out given the stresses and pressures of the role?
It's very hard in the age of social media and where the news cycle is continuous to really try to do the kind of planning and open deliberative work that has to go into so much of thoughtful policy. And I don't see easy ways that we've figured that out at any level, national, regional, local, at any level as of now. And so we see that the speed of technology, the speed of policies can't keep up. Regulation can't keep up to keep the public safe when it comes to generative AI. It can't keep up when it comes to so many things now relative to what the private sector can do. I think that the right solutions are going to be very thoughtful, private, public, academic partnerships where we all work with our partners and toward common goals, because there's some things that the public sector can no longer do. And we're never built to do. You see how the defense industry relies on Lockheed Martin for its airplanes. There's no way that government can or should be in the business of making airplanes, for example. Similarly, in healthcare, it's become so complex with payment and regulation and care that we need to have those closed-door conversations with smart people who are all working toward that common public good. And there are not many forums to do that anymore. It takes special leaders who can engender that trust and build those mini communities to have those conversations for thoughtful policy.
Now, I'm really glad you've brought that up, because I know that you've been doing a number of roles where you've been bridging these private and public organizations in healthcare. How do you sort of ensure that you stay true to the values that you've mentioned, the values that you've expressed throughout your career, working in those commercial spaces where the incentives, the financial incentives to make a business that is sustainable and that grows, may come into conflict with perhaps the broader ambitions of a public health system?
I'll give an example I think that will be helpful. There was a boy by the name of Rory Staunton, who was 12 years old, playing in his school gym, got a little cut on his arm, not feeling well. Eventually, 2 days later, went to the emergency room, was seen and discharged, continued to feel ill, went back to the emergency room a few days later, seen, they drew blood, they discharged him, and then died of sepsis. Young, healthy, vibrant kid, and the systems failed. The systems, even though they had drawn blood, they didn't get him in time. And what that taught me was there were huge opportunities to create smart regulation around sepsis, which kills more Americans than breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, and on combined. But there isn't the same kind of advocacy for sepsis. We created regulation that mandated, and these were called Rory's regulations, early identification and aggressive treatment of sepsis in an evidence-based fashion that Northwell, Kaiser Permanente, and many others were already doing. When someone on the team thinks sepsis, they start a sepsis clock, and you pump the patient full of fluids and antibiotics without waiting as quickly as possible. You don't worry about congestive heart failure, kidney failure, anything else. You just get them treated right away. If you think sepsis, act on it. And that saved tens of thousands of lives in New York based on independent studies done and published in JAMA and New England Journal since then. And we're now working with Senator Schumer's office to federalize some of those policies. The private sphere has a very important role to play in this space, right? The data systems required, the technologies for early diagnosis, all of these can and should make money in the process of saving lives. Now, how much money is too much money? What is the appropriate level of investment to create this kind of innovation? Those are questions that can and should be debated, but it doesn't get starker than the black and white of sepsis and alive or dead, or multi-organ failure versus alive. So there are some places where it's easier to make these determinations in partnership with the private sector, saying, you know, these are the kinds of things we need at a national level. The CDC can do X, the national systems can do Y, but we need private partners to do Z, A, B, C, D. That's the kind of thing where we know the limitations of the public sector. We know the limitations of the CDC and how dependent we are as a nation on legacy systems with inadequate funding. As a result, to get into the 21st century, leveraging generative AI and all of the new exciting technologies there are, it is going to be the private sector that makes us move fast. Now, they can move fast and break things, or they can move fast with guidance. And that's my approach has been to work with others to provide that deep guidance so fewer mistakes are made and the systems to meet the needs of the public are widely available with profit built in for the players, but not the kind of obscene profit that you're seeing in some parts of healthcare.
Yeah, just picking up on the comment around fast, I would add fast and fair, right? We know that with the COVID-19 pandemic, certainly exacerbated a lot of the unfairness within the healthcare system and inequity. And so it's nice to hear that there is some of bridge building between those two communities, because I think the flip side to this conversation is to say, well, you know, actually, if we don't create these relationships, private sector and other interests will go off and do what they think they want to do. And so without that bridge, you lose that important and powerful stakeholder. How do you think we better build that integration between the private and public health sector?
There's a lot of mistrust between the two. Right? The private sector thinks about government bureaucrats who've done things the same way for 20 years, don't even know how to use Slack or email, and are stuck in their ways and don't want to try new things. And meanwhile, the public sector talks about the private sector as those greedy bastards who just want to make money at any cost and don't actually think about the downstream consequences to people and implications beyond the bottom line. And they're both wrong. To the extent that they get together and understand one another and understand the levers that each has that the other doesn't, that's what leads to those incredible outcomes. It's hard to have those conversations. I know the CDC has been doing a great job recently, for example, around data innovation and hosting innovation days where private companies are presenting on stage and having conversations with a few hundred people in the room. I think today they're actually in Seattle meeting with Amazon and Microsoft and others around data innovation. And that's exactly what we need. Is not only is it all right to have conversations with the private and public sphere together, but you need to do this proactively, because today you just can't do what you could do 50 years ago when it wasn't as advanced. We absolutely need one another to make things happen in this complex environment.
And this kind of actually dovetails quite nicely with some of the beginning of what we're talking about is creating trusted relationships. And I think one thing I'm reflecting on here is that these relationships don't just start overnight. If there isn't a relationship, yes, it needs to start the next day overnight, but then it needs to be enduring. And I think it's quite easy when people, you know, political things change or health systems get reformed or whatever, those relationships then disappear. And it's hard for people to kind of bring them back together again. So it's quite inspiring to hear that there is a more of an outreach and maybe a more ambition to collaborate with these types of groups. Now, I wanted to pick up on one of the roles that you have, which is quite interesting. You are an independent director for a company called Steris. I believe that they are a global company that does work around sterilizing medical equipment and cleaning. I wondered, what is it like to sit on a board of such a big company? What do you bring to that board? And what is the experience like?
I am very lucky to sit on the board of Steris. I think it's been such an education. What a privilege. And it is such a fantastically run company that it makes the job of directors very easy when management continues year on year to think proactively and do so well. For me, I think there's several things that I encourage anyone who has the opportunity to take advantage of being on a public company board to absolutely raise their hand and say yes if it's a well-managed company and it aligns with your interests and ability. I'm the only doctor practicing physician on that board. And certainly my whole career has been focused on quality and safety, which is what that company is about. What Steris has done in the surgical suite and other places is about infection prevention. And work that I've done over the years with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, certainly while at Kaiser Permanente, and as health commissioner, all of those have been focused on improving the quality and safety of care. Steris does the same. So what I bring to the board are perspectives of healthcare payment from my time at Kaiser and overseeing the Medicaid program, both public and private payers. The regulatory environment, having been a regulator, a recovering bureaucrat, and also from the clinical perspective. Those great boards work well when there's a diverse set of characters speaking and arguing and having healthy debate around important questions. So, for example, during COVID, I certainly brought a lot of firsthand clinical knowledge to the being a board member and prescribed a lot of Paxlovid to friends on the board. But beyond that, I think it's always about looking for that diverse mix of people who all can have and create a really great culture that leads to the kind of stewardship a board should have in 2023. You have to know the role of management versus the role of board members and stay in your lane, so to speak, but also step up and speak up and talk about questions related to strategy, what you're seeing, and really help the company achieve its vision, whatever it may be.
Thank you for those reflections. I think that as clinicians, often when we look at our careers, we can see a particular train track that we just go in that sort of direction. And I think clinicians have a lot more to offer in very, very diverse places, such as boardrooms, such as in the public service. And it's really helpful to hear that yourself has been successful in contributing and bringing that clinical voice to some of these spaces that at times may not always have that frontline type of perspective. Now, as we draw to a close, there's a lot of challenges on the horizon for healthcare, but I'll be curious to hear about what you are most hopeful about.
Where I've been really excited and even over the last 3 years, we've had an explosion of data available in medicine and healthcare that allows us to look at problems in ways that we never were able to before and uncover opportunities. You know, the opposite of a problem, the flip side is an opportunity for significant improvement. You know, there are no really low-hanging fruit. On the other hand, there are many areas that we haven't explored. I'll give you an example of one. We now have really good data on family caregivers, unpaid family caregivers, folks like my mom taking care of my father with dementia and keeping him independent at home as opposed to an institution. And we know from really good data from the AARP that unpaid family caregivers now contribute approximately $600 billion, that's with a B, of care every year, on top of the $4 trillion that we attribute to the healthcare delivery system. So there's a silent workforce doing incredible things, caring, providing care, keeping people independent, that is totally ignored, that isn't submitting receipts to insurance plans for payment, and yet are an important part of keeping healthcare costs down, but at great expense to their own health, you know, to their own independence, to their own, and experiencing burnout. That's an example where we never had such data 10, 15 years ago, but we now can look at the different facets of the problem with data and create the right set of evidence-based policies and programs to support family caregivers, whether you're a health system provider, whether you're an insurance company, whether you're the government, and you're now seeing the Raise Family Caregiver Act and other work at the federal level, supporting family caregivers until now had no voice. That's the kind of example that I'm very excited about, where there are many more opportunities based on data we didn't have to start to understand complex problems and get toward reducing suffering, improving outcomes, and lowering costs simultaneously.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the way that sometimes when we turn problems upside down, we can identify new opportunities. And that really sounds like centering the patient and their family at the core of healthcare, which is where they should be. So, Dr. Nirav Shah, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Jonah. It was very generous of you to include me. And good luck with this podcast and all that you're doing.
And that brings us to the end of the podcast. If you want to go deeper about any of these topics or join the discussion, visit our website, clinicalchangemakers.com. Now, one small ask. This is a brand new podcast, so if you enjoyed our work, please rate us and share it with your friends and colleagues. Until next time, take care.